Good. Okay, I'm going to gavel in the long-term care division. So welcome, members. I'm glad to see everyone here. And I believe we do have a quorum, so we can proceed. I just want to preface what we're going to do today, just to give you a background. We're here to learn about the disability weight waiver system and home and community-based services reimbursement models, both within the waiver system and outside the waiver system. A lot of members are hearing from constituents, advocates, and people at the Capitol about reimbursement rates and a 7% cut. So I want members to understand so they can communicate that understanding to their constituents and to their colleagues. This is a very complicated issue. We have a lot to learn. I'm excited to be here. According to our state demographer, we're going to have a lot of spending in the near future because of the aging demographics of our population. So this is a priority for this committee. We're going to tackle some big issues, work, I hope, in a very bipartisan way to come up with solutions that we can get through this year and next year. So welcome to the committee. With that, I'm going to, do introductions of the members that we have around the table, because I don't think we all know each other. We have new members here, so we want to start with Ginny.
I'm Ginny Claiborne. I'm a first-time elected representative, and I represent the city of Plymouth, District 44A.
Jeremiah Wingstead, House Republican Research.
State Rep. Glenn Grunegan.
Elizabeth Clarkfist, House Research.
Danielle Pinelli from House Research.
Lindsay Hansen, Committee Legislative Assistant.
Jen Schultz.
Chris McCall, Committee Administrator.
Representative Todd Lippert.
Doug Berg, I'm the House Fiscal Staff.
Sandy Mason, I represent 51A.
Jeremy Munson, represent House District 23B.
Liz Olson, represent District 7B, which is central and west parts of Duluth.
Great. Well, welcome, members. So in your packet, you should have the rules of the Long-Term Care Finance Division. And I just want to point out rule number 7. We are going to have similar rules to that of the larger division of Health and Human Services Finance. So rule number 7 is that substantial amendments should be filed in advance if possible. Because we meet every Monday, you may not mail do the 24-hour rules. So we can also take minor amendments in committee. But I really encourage you to pre-file any large amendments before we meet on Monday afternoon. Any questions about the rules as you read through those? None? Okay, seeing no questions, we'll move on. So our big item of business is to bring down Department of Human Services. We have two presenters that are going to be talking about home and community-based services workforce programs and payment rates. We have Alex Bartolik, who is the Director of Disability Services Division within the department, and Carrie Benson, who is the Director of Aging and Adult Services Division at DHS, and they have a presentation. You should see the slide deck in your packet. And I believe we are able to post these online for people watching at home after the committee. So thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here with my colleague, Carrie Benson, who will introduce herself in just a moment. We're here to talk today about the workforce, about the home and community-based services, what are they, what are the different programs, how do we pay for services, and some information about what we know about the changes in the workforce, which are critical to being able to support people with disabilities and older adults in Minnesota to live at home, to be able to have jobs, to be able to participate in community life. We are setting a context about all of home and community-based services. It's a little bit of a bubble. And if you don't look at the whole and the context, sometimes decisions actually play out in different ways. And we are going to give an overview of home and community-based services, talk about the methods for rate setting, challenges that are facing the direct support professional workforce, and draft data evaluations and policy solutions. And throughout this, we will be using the term direct support professional. to talk generically about people who are providing direct support, whether it's through PCA services or waiver services. It is a term that has been used nationally. Much of the research, when they're looking at how to build up a strong workforce, will use that term. And so that's just a very generic term to cover all the workforce.
And I will start with providing an overview of home and community-based services. My name is Carrie Benson. I'm the director of the Aging and Adult Services Division at the Department of Human Services. And just to step back even a step further in terms of the big picture, we talk about long-term services and supports, or sometimes referred to as long-term care. Long-term services and supports is the full range of services and programs that support people with disabilities and older adults no matter what setting. So it could be in their own home, it could be in institutional settings, but these are the services that provide help to people with their personal care or other activities of daily living. So long-term services and supports is that broader umbrella term. And then we talk about within long-term services and supports, home community-based services. Those are the services provided to people with disabilities or older adults in their own homes or community settings. And they're cost-effective alternatives to institutional care delivered through a range of programs. And you'll see that listed on the slide here, ranging from medical assistance, which is what we call Medicaid here in Minnesota, medical assistance state plan, home and community-based services, the home and community-based services waivers, other federally funded services that are home and community-based services also, but not through medical assistance, and then additional state and local funded supports and services. As I mentioned, on average, home and community-based services offer a cost-effective alternative to institutional care, to institutional long-term services and supports. This graph shows the average monthly cost of long-term services and supports for both older adults and people with disabilities, comparing just at a very high level home and community-based services as compared to institutional services in January of 2017. These are both cost-effective alternatives on average, but they're also the alternatives that people most prefer. And now we will start delving into each of the different home community-based services programs that we will talk about today. In terms of the medical assistance state plan home and community-based services program, through this program, there's a comprehensive benefit set that is available. And these services include a range of medical and health-related services, assistance with the day-to-day activities to people in their home, including personal care and other services. Under this umbrella is services including personal care assistance, which you might have heard referred to separately in other ways, but is under this rubric of for the Medicaid Medical Assistance State Plan, home care nursing and home health aid. Just as a note, as a comparison to when we talk about the home and community-based services waiver programs, these state plan services have rates that are set and do not vary by person.
When we talk about home and community-based service waivers, we are talking about programs that provide additional supports beyond what people can get through the regular state plan. So personal care assistance and nursing might be sufficient. That might be all people need, and that is fine. But if they need more support, if they need support to actually be available to them in their home that helps teach different activities, if they need help with employment or transportation or home-delivered meals, some of these activities, they can be covered through medical assistance, through home and community-based waiver services. They're called waivers because when they first began, medical assistance or Medicaid only paid for institutional care. You either were living in a nursing home, for example, or an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities or a hospital setting. Medicaid would pay for your services there, but if you wanted to return home and live at home with a family or being able to get a job and not be in an institution, medical assistance didn't pay for it. So in the early 80s, there was a change in federal law which allowed states to waive, or the federal government to waive, some of the conditions and requirements about the use of Medicaid in institutional settings. According to plans, states submitted showing how they would meet certain assurances. So they're called waivers because they waive certain federal requirements. One of the assurances that they have to do is home and community-based services have to be cost neutral or less expensive than institutional services on the average. That's an example. As we start talking about some of the different waivers, I just want to give a short history about the management of the waivers. When these first started, the administration for the waivers went through all of it went through counties. So counties were given responsibility. They were responsible for developing providers, writing contracts, setting rates, in many cases determining if the providers met standards, monitoring how services were delivered, and they actually even paid the providers, and DHS just reimbursed counties. That part changed in the mid-90s when providers were enrolled and were being paid directly, but based on authorizations that counties made in the system. Over time, there have been changes. The elderly waiver and many of the services for older adults are integrated with basic health care services and managed through managed care. And if you have questions, Carrie can answer more questions about that. For the disability waivers, which include a waiver for people with developmental disabilities who would have been at risk of institutional care in an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities. It included brain injury for people who would have been eligible for nursing facility or more intensive hospital services. It included CADI or community access for disability inclusion that was for people at a nursing home level of care, or else our community alternatives for people at hospital level of care. All of those waivers have been managed through counties, but in 2014, there were significant changes where we ended county contracts with individual providers, and the state established statewide standards through 245D licensing, and also developed the disability waiver rate system in order to be able to have a statewide strategy for negotiating rates. Now, some of these changes were already started through legislative process. Providers, for example, had submitted many bills wanting us to have one single set of standards for home and community-based services because they were responding to a lot of different rules as well as different county requirements. But the federal government, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also said, Minnesota, you have to change how you administer these waivers. They felt that we did not have enough oversight over what was happening at a county level, and so we were under a corrective action to establish rate-setting methodologies, service standards, and to eliminate county contracts as we went forward.
I just have one question. Were they concerned about the variation in the reimbursement rates, the geographic variation, and the variation across different providers for the same level of services?
Madam Chair, yes. They were concerned about access and that the variations did not assure equitable access across the state, and that giving counties authority to negotiate rates and to have rate changes fluctuate over time based on when providers came into the system did not support a strong provider community, and it also didn't give people the same access to services.
Thank you. I'm sorry, we have one more question. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your presentation. Where does the formula come from to decide how the reimbursement is spread across the state? Because I've heard from my district that there's a wide variation. They believe they're getting a short end of the stick just like everybody else does. But, is that formula, is that in cooperation with the feds, or is it developed by the department, or?
So we are going to, Madam Chair and Representative, we're going to go into more detail about some of the components that go into rate setting. We developed this with many stakeholders. It took quite a bit of time. We received legislative authorization to begin developing a rate structure in 2009. The legislature saw the results of all of the stakeholder work, the research that went on, the consultant recommendations in 2013, and it took effect in 2014. And there's a lot of information, and we can also give you some of the reports that have done showing how the variation plays out. What was happening is that there was a great deal of variation, not just across the state, but even within one area, depending upon when services were developed. And because we were bringing this up in a cost-neutral way, there were some rates that were going to see increases and some rates decreases. Over time, there have been changes. There's been research done, and the legislature has taken action to increase some of the component values of the rates. So we're starting to see some increases, but we can get into more detail after we've explained it about where we are today as we look at the variations.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So I appreciate those comments. So basically the department is coming up with the formula or setting the rates based on your response. But if a particular area believes they're being way undercompensated compared to the areas around them, do they have an appeal process through the department that they can address this with?
Mr. Talley?
Madam Chair and Representative, the rate-setting methodologies are in statute. And so we bring, and every year since 2013, we have brought recommendations for what should be the values. There has been a great deal of focus on should there be regional variances for rates, what are the factors that go into it. There's been quite a bit of research. This is not an arbitrary process. We've worked extensively both with national consultants, people within the state, providers, to provide recommendations to the legislature. There are ways for individuals, for providers who are serving individuals with exceptional needs to get rate exceptions based on the individual needs of the providers. But if there's parts of the state where it's felt that they have differing costs, that is part of what we report on. That's part of the regional variance factors we have tried to introduce.
Thank you. Proceed, please.
We will keep going. We wanted to make sure you knew that through the waivers, we have five home and community-based waiver programs. One of them is the elderly waiver. There's four disability waivers. There also is a program called Alternative Care, which some of you may have heard of, which provides home and community-based services to older adults. And this is for people who have the need for home and community-based services and have lower income but are not yet eligible for medical assistance. So it's a way of helping support people to stay in their homes with the resources that they have. Little bit of a view about who receives home and community-based services, because sometimes it sounds a little confusing. Our state plan home and community-based services, such as PCA, personal care assistance, these are available to people of any age who meet financial and program eligibility criteria. The disability waivers are for people who at the point of entering the waiver are under the age of 65, and we cover children as well as adults. Now, once they reach their 65th birthday, they can continue staying on. It's just that they have to begin the program prior to age 65 to qualify for disability waivers. The elderly waiver and alternative care is for people who are 65 or older as they come on the program. So there are some distinctions by age, but there's also services that cross over all of them. We have a chart here that just gives you an idea of how many people receive services and what's the total average cost. So under the disability waivers, which again is four waiver programs, we serve over 45,000 people on the average per month. So sometimes when you're looking at different reports, you will see us give annual figures or average per month. We're doing average per month here just to make it more consistent. The average cost over the course of the year is $2.48 billion. For elderly waiver and alternative care, there's almost 28,000 people who receive services. at an annual cost of $466 million. And our state plan home care services for PCA, for example, serve over 36,000 people, as well as home health and nursing at $1.18 billion. There's a little bit of nuance when you go into the forecast. And so when we get to the forecast and you see some of those, we will go through it. Sometimes managed care, for example, will cover it and it will show up in a different area. But we wanted to break this out to try to give you an indication of some of the costs and people served.
Ms. Bertalic, regarding that table, do you have a breakout of the people served just in the alternative care program?
Madam Chair, the alternative care program serves about just over 3,000 people. We can get you the specific number, and then the rest of that 27,800 is for elderly waiver.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will shift into talking about rate setting and how that is done currently through the waiver programs, home and community-based services waiver programs. And as Alex was mentioning earlier, we have been going through quite a transition in terms of the rate setting through the waiver programs for services both for people with disabilities and more recently for older adults served through elderly waiver and alternative care. We have been in transition in implementing formulas, so basically getting those established by yourselves in the legislative statutes for the programs that govern the rates and how those are developed and the specific cost factors that go into each. So we are at different stages with each of our home and community-based services waiver programs in terms of their use of these formulas and how that they are used to establish their rates. As the slide shows, direct support professional wages do account for a component of each of these rates. You'll see there's variation as compared between the disability waiver rate formulas and the aging formulas, but fairly comparable. And that, again, is based on cost and the research done to date in terms of what those costs are. Other cost components that are incorporated into the rate formulas include benefits, supervision, program support and training, utilization and administrative costs. So really covering the full cost of providing these services to individuals in their home or community settings. These cost components are prospective and based on multiple evaluations and ongoing research, as we've mentioned. For example, one of the more recent evaluations completed in this area was completed on the elderly waiver program, and the evaluation found that the use of the Bureau of Labor Statistics codes, the standard occupational classification codes, those are the ones that they're written into statute as a part of the formula, required as a part of the formula, and the evaluation found that they are an accurate reflection of the average wages paid currently to direct support professionals. So that's just one example of the way that we've been using evaluations as we've been able to be authorized and be provided the resources to do those evaluations regarding current formulas in place as well as looking at changes going forward. The evaluation report regarding the elderly waiver program, I will talk about in a little bit more detail and will be released soon by the department.
And as we go through, if you have questions, we also can point you to a number of reports. We have many reports every year that goes and says, what do we know about national trends? What do we know about costs, both in Minnesota, as well as how does that compare with other states? So there is a great deal of information that we can provide you about what went into the development of the rates. I want to talk for a few minutes about the disability waiver rate system and hopefully break it down a little bit because in many ways this was developed with a lot of stakeholders to actually create something that can be easier to understand, that we can go back to every year and say how well are the values or the factors that we are taking into account, how well are they working, and allow for an informed decision-making process at the legislative session. As Carrie mentioned, with our waiver programs, we prospectively set rates. So we do an evaluation of what does it cost to deliver services, and we have a number of different types of services, and the costs are sometimes different depending on the type of service or who is being served. It is paid to providers, but then those provider agencies make a lot of decisions about the best way to deliver it. We're not requiring them to only spend money according to the categories that our research showed us, and we do see that providers have different ways of what will incent staff to stay with them or the best way of providing training. So these are prospective rates that are set. Under DWRS, every service has a formula. And you might also heard the term framework. That's a term we use to try to identify the different formulas. And it sets rates. It's based on component values, all the different parts of what has to go into that. And these are found in state law. And that's one reason why every year there's research and evaluation coming back to say, you know what? This is what we're finding here. We might need to adjust this component value in order to assure that we are paying a reasonable rate. In the disability waiver rate system, we do have an inflationary increase. Right now it's every 5 years. That is in law. That means we don't come back and ask permission to do the inflationary increase. It is in law. The forecast will reflect that. And you may be hearing about people saying 5 years is a long time, and it is a long time, and I know there probably are some proposals to look at can we shorten it up maybe every 2 years to provide for those inflationary increases.
Ms. Bertolic, could you talk about, you use the BLS data to look at wage information. Is that lagged? Is that a two-year lag when you get the data to use in the formula? And also, is that Minnesota BLS data or average nationwide, or do you use medians? Can you just go into a little bit more detail about
that? Sure. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is information about what employers are paying. There are national averages. We do use Bureau of Labor Statistics for Minnesota, and there is a lag. It is a couple of years by the time it's reported and available to us. So that is one way we look to evaluate what are people typically paying, and the categories, we'll talk about it in a minute, but the categories under the Bureau of Labor Statistics are very broad categories. So there is a category that covers most of the services that we deliver, and in statute it identifies what categories of out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics we will look at in order to see has there been a change. In addition, we look at the CPI or Consumer Price Index and what changes. So the formulas are increased based on what we are seeing in changes in the labor market and other inflationary adjustments.
Could you also talk about that inflationary adjustment on the different components in that model or framework and how that plays out either now or when you get to that in the slide deck?
I will. I'll give you a short answer now to make sure I address it, and then we'll answer in a little bit more detail. The formulas are set up by starting with wages. Wages is the foundational component. And then after that, we look at what type of benefits, what type of training, utilization review. Some services have a lot of activities that aren't direct one-to-one, so we need to take into account all of the cost to a provider for delivering the service, some of their training and their supervision, what it just takes to bill and have oversight. So there's a number of factors, component values. When we start looking at inflation, we first look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and make an adjustment to the formula based on what we know of changes in the cost of labor. And then that multiplies throughout the entire formula. So then everything is multiplied against that in order to get to a final rate increase to account for changes. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, because it has a delay, we are very interested in having more immediate data from providers on what their labor costs are and factors affecting workforce. And we will talk about that a little bit later, but we think in this very dynamic environment, for you to have the very best information, it would be good if every year we could tell you what providers said they're paying right now and what's happening with their workforce so that we have very up-to-date information without the delays that we see in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. When we talk about the rate system, some of our frameworks, some formulas, establish a rate that's the same rate for all recipients. We call these unit-based services. Some of the services include independent living services, personal support, some of our employment services. There's a cost, an average cost to delivering services that doesn't really change that much depending on the person they're supporting. But there's other services that do vary depending upon the unique support plan or living arrangement for people. And this is where we might have a staff ratio. It might be that a staff person is working with several people at one time. We need to understand that staff ratio. An example of this is when we have one, two, three, or maybe four people living together, we need to understand how many staff are needed in order to provide general support. And if the person needs some individual one-on-one staffing hours in that, we want to get that. If there's need for additional nursing, we want to look at that. There are also variations depending on the type of staffing. We are in an environment where technology can do some pretty wonderful things to support people very well in a way that's very respectful. We need to pay for that type of monitoring and remote technology, but it's a different cost than if somebody is staying at home, staying with a person, or if there is a way of having people alert them when they need some assistance. So some of the frameworks are based on the individual plan for the person. For these frameworks where you have to put in particular information, there is a negotiation between the provider and the case manager to say this is what the support plan should be. There's a form that providers fill out to summarize what they understand will be provided. It goes to the counties, which we also, you may hear the term lead agency. Counties and tribes have authority to be able to help manage this. And they will go through, they have to make sure, does this make sense? Is it equitable across other services? Can they afford it within the overall dollars available to them? But then they manually enter that information into a spreadsheet that's in the disability waiver rate system, and it's actually part of a support planning process. We have an electronic support plan where people put in information, they enter it in, and that's what authorizes services. So it allows for a great deal of individualization that's based on what a team thinks is important, but it does lead to manual work that has to go on in order to get the correct service authorization. And this is an example to talk through this a little bit, and I kind of lost track of where I was. But this is an example for day training and habilitation. So with a day training and habilitation provider, DT&H provider, someone who's going to get day services, the team with the provider, the case manager, the person, their representative needs to decide what's the staffing ratio need to be. We do have a customization of someone's deaf or hard of hearing to allow the provider to have additional funds to help cover the cost of staff that are trained to be able to use sign language or to help interpret. They look at if there is licensed practical nurse or registered nurse that needs to be available, and also where the county where the person is living. And this is an example. I know it's hard to see. We can get you all of this information. It's all available online. You can go in and play with it if you want to try it. But if you can see on here, there are yellow boxes. And on this idea, this gives you an example. When you go into the system, it says for direct staff what the average wage is, how many hours per day, but then you put in a staffing ratio. That has to be entered by the county. as well as if there's going to be any customization or any additional nursing. It's only those yellow boxes that have to be added. Otherwise, the formula lays out all the factors that go into the rate, but this is a way of assuring that things that will affect the rate for an individual on this type of service, where there might be differences depending on shared staffing or other things unique to the person, where they would enter it into the system. From that, the provider gets a copy of a service authorization that tells them what they can bill for, and the person and the case manager also have a record so people understand what the agreement is around the services.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. You know, I hear from my area that we have staff shortages and that there's a high turnover rate. You see that over the entire system, or is that just certain areas? And if so, what do you attribute that to? I've been told certain things, but I'd like to hear what your perspective is.
Madam Chair and Representative, we do have a workforce shortage across the entire state. And some of it's just plain demographics. We have more people who need services, and we have fewer people entering the workforce. We also know that this particular workforce is the lowest paid, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the comparisons that we've been finding against other occupations that have similar training or experience requirements, which help illustrate why providers have a hard time recruiting and retaining a workforce into this. It also is a system that doesn't have very explicit ways that you can build a career, be rewarded for staying in your position for longer. Certain providers may have that, but as a system, there's some different ways we could approach that. We will be addressing that further in the presentation because it is a fundamental shift. Even if we had a lot of money, and I'm recognizing that that's a really big statement there, that I know that we don't have all the money that we might need to put into it, but we don't even have the people that we would need to hire. So we need a combination of factors to really build up a support system for people.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up comment. Yeah, I see that in my own area, and, you know, it's very disconcerting, especially with the demographic change we're seeing coming with the baby boomers, you know, retired. One idea that I've heard, and I just want to see what your thoughts are, is, you know, I sold long-term care insurance for about 20 years, okay, in my agency. But, you know, there's a lot of family members just that would like to take care of in their home a person that needs home health care or even nursing home, but they can't afford to do it. And, you know, when I look at my people in my district who have a disabled child, they can have immediate family members or PCA or whatever get paid an hourly rate to take care of that young child or disabled child. But I don't see a similar plan to address that with long-term care, home health care, or whatever. And is there any consideration? I notice you can apply for waivers. Is there any consideration to look at something like that? Because I hear that all the people like to stay in their home, just like your presentation has shown. But a lot of times they can't have somebody to care for them, and there's immediate family members that would like to care for them. I also think we'd see a reduction in complaints if we would see more family members taking care of their you know, their elderly parents or grandparents or whatever. Any comments on that?
Ms. Fratale?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'll start, and Carrie may have some things to add into. Through our waiver service programs, we do have a service option. It's called consumer-directed community supports, and through that option, there are provisions for parents, family members to be paid. The personal care assistance program also has ability for family members to be paid. There are some constraints on who's the legal representative representing the person to make sure that there's not a conflict of interest. That's certainly an area that we are looking at how to expand, and there will be a report coming out to look at some different ways we could restructure the waivers to really try to highlight the ability for people when they have family members, friends, or neighbors to be able to hire people they know or trust to be able to deliver services.
Ms. Bertolic, where is the state of Minnesota compared to other states in moving away from institutions and really trying to age at home, age in place?
Madam Chair, Carrie and I will both address this. For people with disabilities, we're doing very well. We have closed state hospitals, which is one thing. I think there's about 9 states that have closed state hospitals, so we're one of that crew. We have 94% of people are living in their communities, receiving home and community-based services compared to institutional care. We're seeing the intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities. We're seeing that decreasing significantly. We expect over the next few years to continue to see reductions as more people are really interested in home and community-based services.
And, Madam Chair, I would say for the older adult population, we're seeing much of the same trends in that we do have more people that we're serving as a proportion of the total older adults we serve through across our long-term services and supports programs being served in their own home and in the community. And we see that we're maintaining that. The proportion might grow also into the future, but we are aware of the fact of what we were just talking about, the workforce shortage and challenges to that too. One of the areas where we've been recognized nationally is our support for family and friend caregivers, and so we see that as an area definitely of interest to many of us, it sounds like, and an area where we want to continue to expand our work and our resources to really make it possible for those families and family members and friends who are caregiving or who would want to be able to maintain that role and maintain their own health longer.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Benson.
I'm going to continue with DWRS, the Disability Waiver Rate System, and I want to talk a little bit about banding. And banding is a term that is used to talk about the transition that is being in place to move from this county set rates that were variable across the entire state to use of the framework for all of the services. Banding was authorized by the legislature initially for 5 years in order to give us time to finish doing research, to help providers anticipate where their rates were going to be and being able to make adjustments. A sixth year of banding was added in part because it was a pretty big transition and we wanted to make sure we had enough time to really look at all of the factors that were going into it. This period is also talked about as rate stabilization because there are relatively minor changes made to the rates for most services that were in place in 2013 until we worked through this period of banding. Current law has banding ending on December 31st, 2020. However, their federal approval was only for the sixth year of banding, which ends December 31st, 2019. We did, when the legislature authorized the seventh year of banding, we have submitted it to CMS, and we actually expect to hear their conclusion to our request to extend banding for a seventh year this month. So we shall know soon about whether or not we will have the authority to continue banding. At the end of banding, all services will be provided according to the disability waiver rate structure. And there's been quite a bit of information to help individual providers to look at regional changes to understand what's going to be the impact of it. There's about 27% of the services are currently provided through rates that aren't banded. So they get all the legislative changes, but it's about 70% of rates are banded, so that there's a number of services that will transition at the point that we move into full use of the waiver rate system. And then we get to that point, there still is a transition because it occurs over the course of time as people's services are renewed over the next year following that. Rate adjustments during the banding were minimal. Again, it was trying to provide some stabilizations to keep providers from having more dramatic swings and give them time to anticipate. During this time, there has been research done, and the legislature has made changes to some of the component values in the disability waiver rate system. The legislature also authorized what we call after-model adjustments, where there were increases that were put in. And then there is this five-year inflationary adjustment that is done automatically every 5 years. And this is a picture to try to give a little bit of an idea. We started the disability waiver rate system in 2014. So it was based on rates that were in effect in 2013. During this time, there have been after-model adjustments, which is the top line, and there was a 1% passed by the legislature, then there was a 5% passed by the legislature, and then there was a 1%. These were adjustments that were made to the rate. But the legislature was also making changes to some of the component values. Now, the in-model adjustments is when we're saying a value is changed. So, for example, there were some wage rates that were adjusted. There were some changes in what we were paying supervisors that had to be adjusted. What we were paying when people were sleeping, we had to adjust because the labor laws changed and we needed to make sure we were complying with that. There were changes authorized by the legislature in what we consider when we look at absence and utilization. So the in-model adjustments are things that are put into the formulas. These changes occur at the point that a service is no longer banded. The after-model adjustments actually went into effect at the point that they were authorized. In 2018, when we went through the first five-year inflationary adjustment, we went through the entire formula of everything that is in law that goes into considering what the rate should be: wages, benefits, training, supervision, program costs, utilization, administrative costs. What does it take to do that? And again, it started with what's the wage change? How much more are we paying in wages? And then it starts multiplying the calculation to come up with what the rate should be. The new rates through the waiver rate system were intended to account for the increased costs that providers have. Part of the issue that we've been having is that these after-model adjustments aren't based in any component value. We can't look and say, this is what it was for, this is how it's changed. We're looking at changes in workforce, we're looking at changes in inflation as we go forward. So the waiver rate system, if you were to look at the components of being able to say what's the basis for a change, is what's inflation and Bureau of Labor Statistics on top of any adjustments the legislature makes to the in-model adjustments. The after-model adjustments were something that was hard to reconcile with CMS because they were saying, didn't you just adjust your rates for everything that you know about changes in cost? They are fine if after we do an inflationary increase, and let's say we did it in 2018, and you hear things now that say we have to change some of the wage values or we need to step up how frequently we do inflation. The legislature can add inflationary adjustments over time, but when we rebase, when we go back and do that inflationary adjustment, they're expecting that we're incorporating all the costs in coming back out with a change. We will talk a little bit later about a way there may be to embed dollars in the system in what we're calling a competitive workforce factor that we can actually monitor over time. We can tell whether we're making a difference with our investments. So we will touch on that in a little bit about a different way of infusing dollars into the system that actually shows up as a component value that we can evaluate.
Ms. Bartel, can you explain a little bit about an inflationary adjustment, because it's a multiplicative model that we have if we adjust the wages using the BLS data or wage increases, and then we use that wage and we multiply 10% or something for the non-wage factors in the model, how that works itself through the model, and whether we're actually, when we do that, increasing it by more than inflation.
And Madam Chair, that is the potential for doing that. If we start with what is the change, what is the increased cost to providers for wages and related compensation for workforce, and if we start the changes in the formula based on that, you can end up, if you are also adding in CPI changes, you can end up with higher than you would typically expect. It's also why it's difficult when we have an after-model adjustment. We've already gone through a formula that's multiplied all these factors. So it's saying if you're increased cost, well, of course you're going to have increases in utilization or absence factors or supervision cost or more documentation. We should have incorporated that. After-model adjustments that also give another increase make it even higher than what we typically would expect for inflation.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. On the salaries, you know, the other complaint I hear or have heard over the period of time is that the people actually giving the care don't get paid very well compared to the supervisors or the administration of it. Whether that's true or not, I know what human nature is in general. But is there a ratio? You know, I generally don't like ratios in the private sector, but where government money is concerned, I mean, if the lowest paid employee, is there a multiple that the supervisor can only be paid so much over that lowest employee, or is that uncapped? Do you follow my question?
Ms. Petrali?
Madam Chair and Representative, there is nothing in the formula that establishes a cap. However, we did receive authority for providers every 5 years, and it's on a rolling basis, so about 20% of providers a year will be providing us with cost information so we can understand the picture of what they are spending their dollars on. And we also would like to have annual workforce data so we can understand how the investments in the services are playing out with actual wages. But there's nothing that requires them to spend money in a certain way.
Representative Gruenhagen?
Oh, thank you. Thanks for that answer. The reason I say that is because, you know, I served on the school board, I won't tell you how many years, but for quite a while. And one of the things that really irritated teachers was the multiple ratio of what superintendents and administrators would earn compared to them who are actually in the classroom teaching the students, okay? And, you know, again, when government money shows up, I in the private sector, I generally would be opposed to it. But in government settings, I've seen how this works over time. And I do think some type of ratio might at least be discussed. Whether or not to implement something like that, I'm not sure. But there's always a concentration of salary and benefits at the upper echelon. And the difference between the lowest paid employee and the top one tends to be expanding rather than staying the same or contracting a little bit. And those are the people actually giving the care. So anyway, just a comment for people to consider and think about as we move forward.
And I'd like to respond a little bit. So outside the waiver system for personal care attendants, I believe there's something in statute that says the wages will go up by 72.5% when reimbursement rates increase. And I don't think there's something similar on the waiver side, DWRS side, that suggests if we increase reimbursement rates, it necessarily will trickle down to higher wages. And you make a good point. We're here to figure out these workforce shortages and depressed wages in this area. And so we should consider things that we can do. We can control in statute to make sure rate increases go to wages. Representative Gruenhagen?
Madam Chair, it'd be interesting to just see in the last 5 or 10 years how that ratio between the lowest paid and the top, if it's continued to expand, stayed the same, or decrease. I think that'd be a interesting thing to understand, because if it's constantly increasing, it tells us that there's probably a little adjustment that needs to be made somewhere along the line.
Work on that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So moving to the elderly waiver and the aging rate setting formula, this was authorized by the 2017 legislature. And again, this is a formula based on cost factors. The formula was evaluated in 2018, and the report with the findings from that evaluation and our recommendations will be released soon. Currently, I do want to note that the new formula is only determining 10% of the current rates as outlined in the current statute. So that's 10% of the rates paid to providers. 90% is still based on historical rates paid to providers of services in these areas. And also want to note that the aging rate setting formula does not at this time include inflationary updates. Due to the partial implementation of the new formula, the rates for many of the home and community-based services provided to older adults are lower than the new rate setting methods produce. So full implementation, as you can see by the column in the middle or second from the right, full implementation of the rate setting methods would make more dollars available to providers to pay direct support professionals. Again, DHS does not provide the professional, pay the direct support professional wages, but that's incorporated as a part of the overall rate paid to providers for these services. So you can see the difference between the current rates and what the rates would be at full implementation of the new formula do vary considerably across services. And again, the new formula is based on the cost to provide these services, and that was largely based on a provider and wage cost survey and other research data that we had available to us to determine what those the actual costs are at this time.
I do want to talk about PCA, or personal care assistance, for a minute, because we've been spending a lot of time talking about home and community-based waiver programs. PCA is different. It's a state plan service. There is no framework or formula for establishing rates for this PCA program. And it is a lower paid service. So right now the rate for a 15-minute unit of service is $4.35 or $17.40 for an hour. That's for the entire rate that includes what you're going to pay the worker, any benefits, any training, any utilization, as well as the administrative work associated with that. Now, this is where 72.5% of the rate must go to direct support professional wages and benefits. So it is more than just wages. It does have in law some expectation that most of the rate is supporting the people who are actually delivering the services. There is no framework, as I said, and PCA rates have been adjusted periodically through legislation. Starting in 2015 and since then, these legislative changes have been the result of collective bargaining with SEIU for the home care workforce. The evaluations that we've done across all of our home and community-based services and looking at what's the industry of direct support workers show that the PCA workers are the lowest paid workers in our home and community-based service system.
And we've been talking quite frequently during this presentation about needing to know more about the direct support professional workforce and wages in particular. And what I do want to highlight in terms of the data we have available to us, it comes from our use of one-time voluntary surveys, other data about compensation, as we've been able to do as funding has been available to inform our rate setting. But as Alex had mentioned earlier, we do see a gap and are very interested in being able to have ongoing authority and resources to really be able to collect as close to real-time data as we can on the workforce and workforce across all of our home and community-based services programs, so we can have a clear understanding about the costs for worker wages, benefits, and such, but also, of course, the rest of the cost components for our home community-based services program rates. And despite our gaps in data, we do know, of course, that there is a workforce shortage. We expect this to continue. Our Department of Employment and Economic Development estimates that we will need an additional 68,000 direct support professionals in the coming years to meet the demand for support across our home and community-based services programs. So this is a significant challenge ahead of us, and, of course, one that we are already experiencing. The next slide shows this graphically where we are seeing job vacancies. It illustrates the direct support professional job vacancies across years, and you'll see in 2010 the number of vacancies started to increase fairly dramatically. And vacancies right now are at 20-year highs and are expected to get worse as demand for these services grows. In terms of direct support professional compensation, nationally about 45% of direct support professionals live in households earning less than 200% of the federal poverty level. And over half of direct support professionals in 2015 relied on public assistance. So the low compensation affects their quality of life and their ability to meet their basic needs as well. So there's many facets to this challenge that we're aware of and concerned about. Typical wages for direct support professionals are relatively low, as the previous slide really outlined, and many variables do affect those wages and benefits paid to direct support professionals. And, you know, those, of course, are encompassed quite a bit in thinking about local economic factors. What are the other industries in place? What's the competition? What's occurring in border cities? What are the local minimum wage ordinances and other factors? Of course, as we've been talking about, program payment rates directly affect compensation to direct support professionals, including wages and benefits, and these are governed by legislative action. And while we're in transition of developing and implementing the formulas that we've been discussing today to set rates based on costs, some workers have been impacted more significantly. Alex talked about the personal care assistance program that does not have a formula in place. And we're also aware of the variance when an individual needs highly specialized services and the gap between how our current cost formulas might take that into account or they might not, and how that can affect the ability for that individual to have the workers that they need to support them in the way that is most effective and highest quality, but also in the way that they prefer. And one note again is that competitive workforce factor is an item to consider that we feel might provide an additional enhancement in terms of the way our current rate formulas work. Alex highlighted the 15-minute unit rates for PCA services. You'll see that's on the far right-hand side of your slide that you're looking at now, which shows average 15-minute unit rates across many of our home and community-based services programs. So you'll see there's quite a variation from those programs that have been implementing a formula based on costs factors in certain home and community-based services programs compared to those that are a little bit earlier on or PCA that does not have a formula in place at this point.
So we've been talking about what we're seeing as part of an issue that we all are interested in and what are some different ways that we're evaluating and looking at options. And one has to do with the comparative wage analysis to understand how this field of direct support professionals compares with other occupations that have similar education and experience requirements. And when we went through all of the Bureau of Labor Statistics data to compare all the different ways that we are collecting information that goes into what we are calling the direct support professionals with similar education and training requirements, we found that consistently the direct support professionals were paid less. So we are, our rate formulas look at what we are paying and changes in that to look at how to increase. But it's not necessarily from a business perspective what people need to pay in order to be able to recruit and retain a workforce that is going to be competitive in different parts of the state given other industry. And again, we know that the workforce shortage is not specific to direct care or direct support professionals. This is something our state is experiencing as we are having fewer people entering the workforce at the same time. We're seeing increasing demographic change with the number of older people and people with disabilities. This difference, on the average, it's over 17% difference. And what we're calling this difference is a competitive workforce factor, that if we wanted to assure that the wages and benefits for this workforce was competitive with other types of jobs that these workers can look at very easily, it would need to be increased by 17%.
Ms. Bartolak, could you back up a little bit and just briefly give an overview to the committee of what training is required for direct support professionals and PCAs?
So the training requirements are a little bit different, but it's fairly minimal in that provider agencies or people who are doing the hiring need to assure that people understand, for example, maltreatment reporting, that they understand what it means to treat people with respect, that they are learning about how the system works and assuring that they have some of the basics. They're supposed to receive training that's specific to their job. This doesn't require a particular educational background. Some services may, but for generally, it doesn't. There's a certain number of hours that are associated with training, and with the hope that if people receive hours of training, that they will understand a basis of what to expect when they go out. What we're finding is we really want to shift hours of training to competency-based and talk more about what do we expect people to be able to do. The other thing we've found is that you have to be able to work with people, and you can't just sit and have a lot of training before you go in. You need to have some interaction as well. We can get you a list from, for example, the 245D license as well as the PCA statute to give you a comparison of the types of training that are required to be able to deliver services. But as an example, first aid is not required for personal care assistance. To give you, break this down a little bit more, here are some Bureau of Labor Statistics wages in Minnesota. Personal care aides is a very broad category. This is more than personal care assistants and PCA. This is talking about people who are working with people, whether it's in a group home or at a day service or helping them out in the community. We have over 67,000 people with their hourly mean wage of $11.83. And that's compared to customer service representatives in the industries who make $18.51, office clerks who make $17, home health aides who make $12.69, or bus drivers who make $15.97. These are all occupations that have similar experience, education, and training requirements.
In 2018, DHS used a grant with the University of Minnesota to conduct a survey. It was used to fund the survey conducted by the University of Minnesota to collect one-time data from home and community-based service providers across the state. And we've been collecting that data from providers and now have data from close to about 180 providers. The data that Alex will walk through is from the first 107 providers that responded to this survey, but it's quite a broad workforce survey in terms of the data that we've been looking to collect. And again, it's our most recent attempt to really get current, broad-based, consistent data in terms of what the costs are and what are the retention rates and other factors related to the workforce. One of the findings, preliminary, I want to highlight, but one of the findings from this study is hourly wages by region. And so this speaks to some of the regional differences in terms of what the direct support professionals are paid. And so we are showing average full-time wage as compared to average part-time wages across some of our regions in Minnesota.
We wanted to put this next to the rates, just to give you an idea of how the rates compare. So home health aides, the average wage from this preliminary data that is not complete, but compares to a rate per hour that's between $21.96 and $32.04. PCA, the average wage is at $11.75, and the rate per hour is $17.40. For day services, the average wage is $12.34, and the average rate per hour is $39. Waiver residential services, it's $13.16 compared to $34. And these unit-based services, a lot of individualized services, the average wage $12.76 to a rate that's $27.54 or so. So what we find is that an elderly waiver, the waivers are roughly 50% of the hourly rate. And in DWRS, or the Disability Waiver Rate System, they're about 40%. We also wanted to show you what will happen with the average wage compared to the formula. Now, I do want to make you know that in DWRS, 70% of these services are still banded. So providers are not yet using the framework rates, and so they can't adjust their salary scales the same way they will once they're ready to move into the framework scale. But for day services, again, the survey so far is showing that the average wage is $12.34. In the formula, the average wage component of the formula is $15.30. For residential services, the average wage currently is $13.16. And in the formula, when people are fully in DWRS, the average wage will be $13.53. And for the unit-based services, the average wage right now is $12.76. This is a little bit harder to compare because the formula wage components varies quite a bit across different services, so somewhere between $12.27 and $22.38. So that's a less helpful distinction. But it does show that the wages are a component of DWRS. And it is true that certain providers might be paying more, but overall, we expect that the DWRS will offer a higher wage in that rate.
Given that, so the rate's higher in the when they come off banding, you expect, because in the formula, the wages are higher. Is there a guarantee that that's going to be translated to the workers? Even though it's in the rate at a higher wage, will that translate to the workers?
There's nothing in the disability waiver rate system that guarantees that workers will see a higher wage. Last year during session, there were several bills to try to collect annual workforce data so we could report on it. There's different options depending on what the legislature would like to do in order to draw a correlation there.
Okay, thank you.
Some of the other interim survey findings, about 57% of providers offer health insurance to full-time direct support professionals. 52% offer paid time off to full-time direct support professionals. 4% of reported revenues were paid out as overtime costs. And again, we're doing a voluntary sample, and we still have to complete the sample. This was lower than we were expecting. The average turnover was 38.8% over a 12-month period. So not only are you talking about difficulty in filling shifts, but you're talking about people who are having individuals come in and help them with the most intimate tasks that you don't know who's coming into your house from day to day. So that one is a very startling statistic, which isn't surprising. It's just high. And then the providers who completed the survey, just to give you a set of context, they employ over 18,000 direct support professionals and serve almost 18,000 people with disabilities and older adults. And this survey does cover the disability waivers, elderly waiver and alternative care, and the PCA providers. We are continuing to do evaluations. This is a really hard topic. It's provider's lifeline. It's a lot of policy decisions that get folded into what we incorporate in rates. So we continue to do evaluations across all of our programs. There often are annual reports letting you know what we have found out about the data. The 2017 legislature did direct DHS to evaluate aging programs to look at base wages and non-wage factors. That report is going to be issued soon. And we also, in statute, have regular evaluations of the disability waiver rate system so that we are to come back and report back what we are finding. And again, part of the missing piece here is getting routine information about the workforce, about what we're paying, about retention, recruitment factors, so that we are able to be much more timely in understanding if the investments are really making a difference in the outcomes we are expecting. There are a number of options that we can use to increase direct support professional job satisfaction, to hopefully bring more people into the industry and help them stay here. In 2018, there was a report that was issued by a work group that included people across state agencies, but also many, many stakeholders who were very interested, from providers, advocates, the university, people who receive services, and people who deliver services. There is a report about many recommendations they came up with that they felt the state should do, and it's broad. Some of it's very foundational, such as what do we pay, but it also gets into how do we train, what are different ways of helping high school and college students, for example, learn about this as a career. So it has a wide variety of activities, but their number one top recommendation is how do we increase wages, because when people are living in poverty or near poverty, it's very difficult to keep them in a field, whether this is their chosen field or if it is a step into something else. So some of the options that we have been looking at in combination with a number of stakeholders and advocates is, one, establish a rate-setting methodology for PCA services. It would help you as decision makers if you knew what were the factors that you were making decisions on to affect the PCA rate. And by having a framework which says this is what we expect for average wages, for training, for what we expect for the administrative costs, it would give us a way of evaluating that and giving you more information to make decisions about PCA services and their rates.
Another recommendation we have is to fully implement the elderly rate setting formula. So that's the rate setting formula that was authorized by the 2017 legislature and evaluation just completed. So the full implementation can be really building off of the 10% implementation where we're at now, and use the findings from the evaluation to make tweaks as necessary to that rate formula.
Another option for consideration that has come up repeatedly as we've worked with stakeholders is to add a competitive workforce factor into these rate frameworks. So as we said, we're looking at Bureau of Labor Statistics to tell us what people have been paying. But in a very competitive market that has changes occurring, and you are making policy decisions through legislation as well as what providers are doing, we need a much more nimble and agile way to really evaluate whether investments are making a difference. Having a competitive workforce factor is a way of saying we're going to infuse dollars into frameworks that can be used to help increase wages or support for direct support professionals. We should be able to see the Bureau of Labor Statistics wages going up. We should be able to see through cost reporting and hopefully wage and workforce data in the future, we should see that going up, which then would actually reduce what we need to put in for a competitive workforce factor to boost it. But right now, if we really want to focus on workforce, we need a very specific way of targeting dollars for that and being able to evaluate whether they're making a difference. We also know in talking with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services about our disability waiver rate system that if we had a competitive workforce factor to infuse dollars into the rate framework, that's a very that's a legitimate way of talking about how do we build a framework that would make sense to them to be able to say the rate should be higher, perhaps, than what we already have had by using that competitive workforce factor to actually put a component in there of a way of adding dollars into the system that we can use to evaluate then the impact it's having on the direct workforce.
And finally, we do look forward to continuing to support your efforts, your deliberations in this area. We greatly appreciate your interest in starting off your committee work in this area and allowing us time to share with you where we're at with home and community-based services across programs that serve older adults and people with disabilities, and look forward to working with our partners, too, to address the challenge.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a final question here. You know, I've served on the HHS Finance and Policy Committees for quite a few years, and, of course, we have this black box with HMOs that, you know, seems like we put more money in, but not as much goes out to the actual providers. At least that's the allegation. And for some reason, we never seem to be able to get to the bottom of it. But in this particular area, my understanding is that HMOs do provide some of these services. So if we give a dollar to an HMO, do we have a verifiable understanding of how much of that dollar goes for administration within the HMO, or is this part of that black box that we're not quite sure of? Do you follow the question?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair, Representative, through the elderly waiver program, about 93% of individuals are served through managed care. Mm-hmm. And so what we do know, and we can come back and provide information or follow up in another way, too, we do know that the fee-for-service rates that are set do inform the capitation provided through the managed care organizations. So we do have information we can share with you in terms of the makeup of that in more details.
So do we know a percent? Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know a percent that they're taking? Do they take 8% for administrative? Do they take 5% or 10%? Do we have anything in law that says you can only take this certain percent for administrative costs?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that percent off the top of my head, but we can follow up for you.
Thank you. Representative Mason has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This summer, I spent quite a long time talking to many people about this issue, and I mean, we have to do something about it. This one woman, for instance, has, right now she only has 10 homes. She said she used to have 14, but because of the turnover and because she likes to be part of the training, she got rid of four of them, and she was just pleading that we need to do something so that we, you know, they can pay their workers more. Another woman works for an agency. Same thing. The turnover is incredible. And she said, it's not because I'm a bad supervisor. We just cannot pay these people enough. And then just trying to get the people that need the services, let alone the workers that are willing to be in this area, just but they can't afford it. So, I mean, this to me is probably one of the most important things as a legislature that we need to accomplish this year.
I second that. And we have control over these reimbursement rates that will translate to higher wages. And it will actually, over the long run, I think, reduce the cost of other Medicaid program that we we spend if we can keep people to age in place and get them services in their home, because institutional facility costs are so much higher. So we really should think of it, if we increase rates, as a cost savings to the state and an investment.
Madam Chair, two questions I have. The first question is, how many, when we're looking at the rates, how many of our workers are part-time and how many are full-time? That's just a general question. And then also a more specific question to, important to the members of my community, is why is it that a personal care attendant is not able to work 48 consecutive hours so that a person could attend a funeral, attend a wedding, without having to take multiple PCAs?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Cleburne. I think maybe the testifiers could answer some of those questions. Ms. Martalek?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, to your first point about how many are full-time and how many are part-time, we're hoping to get more information from this workforce study that the university's doing. It will be an interesting question if we could get data every year to really see if we're making a change in that. Some part of the workforce being part-time means that we have college students and we have others, which is great. But for many people, if they can't work full-time, they're working a second and a third job. So how can we really support that? And I apologize, the second.
Well, the second question was, why is there a limit about the 48 hours, one PCA taking a 48-hour shift?
So there are, Madam Chair and Representative, there are labor laws which set the stage at which point people have to be paid overtime, when they would get time and a half. So there are some laws about when that kicks in, 40 hours, 48 hours. So some agencies literally can't afford to pay overtime very often, so they may prohibit that. We obviously want people to get the right service. The legislature also passed a limit on how many hours in a month a personal care assistant could work, and that was done and set at a limit at 275 hours, which was really trying in a month. That is a lot of hours, trying to say how do we really make sure that people are fresh and they're not being overworked. But again, for many people, if they can't find another person to help support them, or they're going on a trip and there's other circumstances, it might make sense. And again, many of these PCAs, when they reach their limit, they are working another job because they need to have the income.
Thank you. So we're looking forward to seeing the report on the elderly waiver that's going to be coming out later this month. And then if you could send that to the committee, that would be great. And then give us a memo or an email about the decision by the feds on the question of extending the banding. That would be great if you could give us that information as soon as you get it to the committee. I just want to note to the committee members and to the audience that there is a wonderful report put out by DHS on the disability waiver rate system that I encourage. We'll send that link around to members and put it as a link on the committee website. And then we're getting approval to send out a memo summarizing this report that was produced by research, Liam Monahan. That's the best memo we've seen describing the waiver rate system. And it's in the folder. Great. The memo's in the folder. So you already have that. Wonderful. And we'll hopefully post that as well for the community to see and get briefed. I did a lot of research over break to get ready for this committee. I want to make sure our committee members are up to speed and educated. So we don't have a lot of time to meet since we only meet once a week. But as chair, I can call special meetings to tackle big issues that we need to address this session. And so I will send you home with some homework. That is, you feel free to go to the audio files and the video archive files from previous committee hearings in long-term care. In January 14th of 2015, there was a good overview on video of just long-term care. If you need a refresher, we'll send out those links to the committee so you can go through those refreshers on just long-term care. But I want to spend the bulk of this committee really addressing some big issues that we need to tackle this session. And feel free to send me topics you want to learn more about. I have plenty of bill ideas that will address some of these policy recommendations. So if you're looking for bills to carry, contact me. I want to thank our research staff and our committee administrators and CLA to be here. And if you need to get on to testify, contact Chris McCall and Lindsay Hansen. So thank you for helping us with this committee. And thank you for the research staff. So with that, any more comments or discussion? I think we're finished with our official agenda. We will not be meeting next week because of the MLK holiday on Monday. We will send out the agenda for our next meeting, hopefully later this week. Thank you all for coming, and hopefully we'll get to know the people who are here in the audience who are here to advocate on behalf of long-term care and disability. So thank you all for coming as well. With that, I'm going to gavel the committee out. Thank you.